It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, college students are back in dorms, feasting on cafeteria food, pizza, and cups of noodles. And this week's Food Friday, we'll get some advice and recipes for simple meals they can cook themselves without a kitchen. First, 400 janitors in Milwaukee last week negotiated a union contract that establishes a $15 minimum wage. The three-year contract, ratified by Service Employees International Union Local 1, will also make Juneteenth an official holiday and bump wages to above $15 by the time it expires. We're talking about that contract and service worker pay in general, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to see more unionization in Wisconsin, especially in the service sector, or do you think it's not needed? Were you part of this Local One organizing effort? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. John Shelton is an associate professor and chair of democracy and justice studies at UW-Green Bay. He's the author of Teacher Strike, Public Education, and the Making of a New American Political Order. John, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob, and happy Labor Day to everybody out there.
Can you start by talking about the significance of this contract? Not the hugest union deal we're ever going to see in this country, but do you see it as significant for service workers?
Yeah, this is a big deal. SEIU just nationally has been involved for over a decade with the fight for $15. This has been a grassroots movement say that service sector workers and other folks on the lower end of the pay scale have been grossly underpaid for some time, even though the economy has gotten more productive. So, you know, for the vast majority of workers since about the 1970s, their pay has stagnated. And, you know, it's really because of the efforts of groups like these janitors and others that, you know, they've put the $15 an hour wage scale, you know, on the national radar. But more importantly, we've seen, you know, workers now negotiating to get this. We've seen workers organizing to get this politically. And $15 an hour minimum wage at this point is kind of a no-brainer. I mean, it cuts across partisan lines. You know, I'll just remind listeners if they don't remember, back in the 2020 election, you know, Florida, for example, which, you know, supported Donald Trump, a Republican, in that election, also by a pretty large margin bumped up the minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2026. And they've already increased their minimum wage. So this is a big issue. And, you know, this the work of this union and, you know, these workers who organized is a big win for workers. And it'll reverberate, I think, you know, for service sector workers throughout Milwaukee and the Milwaukee area.
Now, this is an existing union. It's been around this union local for quite some time with a new contract here. Can you talk about some of the challenges faced in the service industry when it comes to organizing? I know with a janitorial company, you have workers working often in different sites, not necessarily seeing each other that often. In, say, fast food, you might have high turnover where people are coming and going. Do those things make it harder to organize service workers in many industries?
Yeah, that's definitely the case. So, you know, if you think back to when labor law was constructed, like, you know, the labor law that sort of, you know, governs private sector workers in this country, you know, a lot of the you know, kind of founding assumptions go back to the 1930s. And, you know, when you had these big, you know, work sites, most of your listeners are probably familiar with, you know, factories like automobile factories, and steel factories and the like. And so, you know, when you have that many people under one roof who are, you know, working around similar schedules, it's a lot easier to organize them. And so, you know, for service employees, as you said, Rob, you know, many of whom might actually be at different work sites, have very different schedules, it can be a challenge to organize them. If you want to get into this later, we can talk about this. It doesn't help that American labor law really hasn't kind of caught up with it, you know, kept up with the times. But I think what these workers show is it is possible to organize. And as you mentioned, they've been around for some time. And, And you know, the work that they've done has led to this contract. And so, you know, I do think this is a model for other workers out there looking to organize to be a good example.
We've seen non-unionization efforts working toward $15 minimum wages, especially, and I'm thinking of the fast food industry and the Fight for 15 campaign involving some workers at fast food places, but stopping short of trying to have a union organization drive and then negotiate a contract. What do you think of that kind of middle ground, advocating for that pay change, but not in a formal union setting?
Well, one thing I would remind you of is that actually, you know, from the very outset, the Fight for $15 campaign hasn't got as much media coverage, but the call the entire time has been $15 an hour and a union. So, you know, one of the things that workers have you know, in say the fast food industry have done is, you know, they've sort of tried parallel tracks, right? So to your point, you know, the goal has always been to have a union, because I think what a lot of these workers would say is, you know, a pay increase is good and necessary, but, you know, what they actually, you know, want long term is, you know, more job security, more control over what their working conditions are going to look like. You know, the fact that this janitors union secured Juneteenth as a holiday, you know, when this is a very diverse union, you know, shows that, you know, unions are important for more than just what we might think of as, you know, pay and bread and butter issues. So, you know, that's always been the case for Fight for 15. But you're right. You know, some of these, you know, some of the fast food strikes that people are probably aware of, you know, these were, you know, kind of largely about sort of raising public awareness as much as, you know, the sort of immediate goal of forming a union. And in that sense, they've succeeded, right? And I think, you know, workers in many sectors across the country have benefited from that effort to put this on the political radar and make it something that you know, lots of politicians and lots of political parties are paying attention to.
We're talking to John Shelton, Associate Professor and Chair of Democracy and Justice Studies at UW-Green Bay, looking at a new union contract for service workers, janitors in this case, in Milwaukee, with a $15 wage, looking at what that might mean for workers in the service business elsewhere around the state. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think workers in the service industry should be getting paid $15 an hour? Do you think there needs to be more unionization? Do you see value for that? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Before we go to our callers, John, do you see a road to a minimum wage change via policymakers, especially in a state like Wisconsin, or do you think it's going to come from this kind of effort?
Well, you know, I think, I do think long term, you know, it is necessary to have policy changes, right? And one of these is a minimum wage increase. I think it's also the case that bigger labor reforms are needed too, something like the PRO Act, which makes it, you know, sort of levels the playing field and makes it easier for workers to organize. That's something we can talk about, you know, if that's something that you're interested in later. But you know, I do think it may be that until we get those big pay increases, that until we, you know, get those big, you know, that big legislative pay increase, that it is going to sort of be on workers. And I think that's particularly the case in Wisconsin, right? We have, I think, a legislature, you know, I think folks probably know about gerrymandering at this point, where, you know, the party that's in power, some of the policies they put forward are kind of out of sync with what it is that most of the working people in the state want, which I think is a higher minimum wage. So, you know, what I think we'll see are more efforts like this to organize and try and get higher minimum wages, you know, through collective bargaining. Now, I also think it's the case that, you know, the worker shortage that I'm sure many of your listeners are paying attention to, which is driving up wages right now, you know, it is also, you know, giving workers who are looking to organize leverage. And so I think for those workers who are thinking about how do we, you know, kind of work together to raise our wages absent, you know, some big legislative increase, you know, now as I think these janitors show, is a good moment to do it, because employers are really, you know, worried about worker turnover and, you know, staffing at this moment when, you know, workers have relatively more bargaining power individually than they have in some time.
Talking to John Shelton from UW Green Bay, looking at janitors unionizing in Milwaukee, what that might mean for other service workers in the state and around the city as they look for a $15 minimum wage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you work in the service industry? What do you think needs to change about pay and or working conditions? What do you think of the idea on service work of service workers unionizing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with John Shelton, Associate Professor and Chair of Democracy and Justice Studies at UW Green Bay, looking at a successful bargaining effort on the part of Milwaukee janitors, a union local there getting a $15 wage, and labor issues that service workers face more generally. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Sawyer is with us in Madison. Sawyer, hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Sawyer?
Yeah, I'm a union steward at a grocery store in Madison, and we're currently making $13.80. We're looking at getting our second union contract in January. We're going to begin negotiations then. And our people are already thinking about how MIT has released a study showing that minimum wage in Madison to live in Madison should actually be at the bare minimum $15.50. So for us, you know, when we negotiate in January, we're already thinking of moving beyond the fight for $15 and saying, you know, what can we make? How much money do we need to make to actually live in Madison?
Thanks a lot for that call. And John, that idea of wages not matching up to the cost of living in communities.
Yeah, and I just want to thank Sawyer for that comment because I think it's really important. You know, the kind of high watermark of the minimum wage in the United States was 1968. And if the minimum wage had just kept up with inflation since 1968, workers would be looking at about $24-25 an hour right now. So for a whole number of political reasons, that hasn't happened. But Sawyer's point is a good one, right? It's $15, you know, really began as sort of a political call to illustrate how far out of whack minimum wages were with what workers should actually be getting paid. And I think it's important to note that the janitor's contract, $15 an hour is where they start. So by the end of the 3-year contract, they're actually going to have a wage that's higher than that. And I think the strategy of Sawyer's union is absolutely right, is absolutely the right way to go about it, to think about what it is that workers need, you know, rather than some arbitrary, you know, kind of wage that's, you know, political slogan. I mean, that I think served its time and is still relevant in some cases. But, you know, for folks who have a union and have a good negotiating strategy, you know, I think that makes a lot of sense. So I'm very appreciative of that comment. I think it adds a lot to the conversation.
Sawyer, thanks for calling in. We'll go to Peter now in Milwaukee. Peter, hello.
Greetings. It's great to be on here talking with you. I'm the president of the Local Service Workers Union here in Milwaukee, and thought it'd be great to have a chance to talk with you about the contract victories of service and hospitality workers here. I just want to note real quick, the statistic that John referenced there is slightly off. It's if minimum wage had kept pace with productivity gains, that's what workers contribute to growing the economy. It would be about $24 an hour, not inflation.
Okay. And Peter, tell us more about this contract from your view and if you're looking to replicate that.
Yeah. And I just to build off of some of what John is noting here, a $15 an hour minimum wage is not coming from politicians, whether the federal level, certainly not the state level. And, you know, unfortunately, city and county officials are hamstrung by state preemption laws. So here in Milwaukee, service and hospitality workers have been organizing to establish a labor market wage floor of 15 and up through our union contracts. It started with Pfizer Farm Arena workers over a year ago, winning 15 now. So as of last January, actually, the minimum wage for folks in the arena district was 15. and moving up from there. And earlier this year, other essential workers like the nursing home CNAs, that's a Jewish home, or the Sodexo food service workers over at the Marquette campus fought for and won 15. So this is how workers, in fact, are building a higher wage floor. And this janitorial contract was first and foremost about winning 15 as a down payment on a real living wage, just like the last caller talked about. But really, workers need far more than 15, but to be able to win the true living wage that we need, which is certainly $24 or more per hour, we had to win 15 first. And as John has noted, that's where the movement in the streets has been at. So check that box. This contract campaign was a huge victory for service and hospitality workers, seeing that when you organize through unions, we can fight for and win major demands, but we're not stopping there. And that's why the second aspect of this union contract was so important. The contract campaign really honed in on ensuring that all who clean in Milwaukee have a chance to be covered by this union contract. You know, it doesn't matter whether you clean a commercial office building in downtown Milwaukee or you're emptying a wastebasket and scrubbing a toilet in a suburban office park. Doesn't matter whether you're pushing a mop in a retail outlet in a strip mall or even, you know, cleaning as a housekeeper in a hospital. Frontline essential workers everywhere who are the cleaners that keep us safe, sanitary, and secure should be paid living wages, should have health care, should have a pension, should have dignity, rights, and respect on the job. So this contract campaign was about fighting for and winning a charter for all cleaners in Milwaukee to be covered by this union contract and the opportunity to join together. The truth is, we're not going to win living wages for any cleaners, much less all of us in the industry, unless we have the combined power, that labor market bargaining power that comes from a strong union. So we had to build across the industry, and this contract campaign made that possible.
Peter, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing the insider perspective there with us. John, your thoughts on what he had to say?
Yeah, really, really glad Peter could give us that perspective. I agree with just about everything he said there. You know, just also want to thank him for the corrective. Did I say inflation? I meant productivity. But I appreciate him pointing that out. I think what this really speaks to, you know, if you think about the nature of our economy, for the last, I don't know, as long as I can remember, there's been this kind of fiction, you know, that the only way to have sort of dignity on the workplace is, you know, to get a college degree, to get advanced education, to fill this, you know, supposed, need for, you know, better trained workers. And I'm not saying that training is bad. I'm a university professor and I believe in public education. But the reality is when you look at Bureau of Labor Statistics, you know, the one of the fastest growing, you know, job sectors in this country are in one of the biggest numbers of aggregate jobs in general are service sector workers. They're not going anywhere. And every worker in this country deserves dignity and deserves to have their needs met and to be able to afford the basic, you know, cost of living. And even beyond that, to have, a good, secure life. And, you know, unfortunately, our political system has not, you know, kept up there. And so it's important for workers, you know, in unions like these to fight for it. And, you know, I think, Peter's absolutely right. This will have bigger ramifications than just the 400 workers who are immediately covered by the contract.
Now, John, there might be business owners out there, maybe a fast food franchise or somebody who operates a personal care facility and says, I'd love to pay my people that much. I don't make enough money. I can't afford that. That's been a sticking point in arguments for increasing to, say, a $15 minimum wage. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that is often an argument that folks make. But what I would say to that is, they're just not going to have the choice. I mean, if you look at what's happening with the economy right now, workers have more options now than they used to. And part of this is, I think, you know, what we've seen over the past couple of years is a recognition, you know, from the federal government that there should be some kind of baseline for folks, right? So you look at the Biden administration and the child tax credit and how that's raising the floor, for working folks. And so Employers, they're going to have to reckon with this, because the idea that they can, you know, effectively subsidize profits on, you know, workers who literally can't make ends meet is just not going to be a reality much longer. So if they want to compete and they want to have workers, and, you know, that's the other part of this that I think we don't talk enough about, this contract for the janitors, is this actually going to benefit the employer, because they're going to have less worker turnover and they're going to make sure that they have, you know, the workforce that they need to provide the services that they provide. So in a lot of ways, you could see this as a win-win.
Time for one more caller. Arthur is calling from by Sauk City. Arthur, hi.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call, and thanks for hosting this program. It's a great opportunity to talk about this issue. First of all, I'd like to say that I'm a huge supporter of unions in Wisconsin. The stronger and more robust, the better. But we have had a whole lot of attacks on our ability to organize unions, and there are a whole bunch of rules and regulations. I was curious about possibly using the fraternal order structure to provide like group services for industries, like a service industry fraternity that could do like group health insurance plans. Would that be a possibility, or other ways to unionize less traditional union type workers like bartenders and servers?
Interesting. Arthur, John, is that something that's going on out there?
Yeah, Arthur, I mean, there's been some interesting efforts to do that kind of stuff. I mean, I think about like the Freelancers Union, for example, which is, you know, tried to find a way to take people who are sort of in more, I guess, I hate to use this term, but just for expediency's sake, you know, less sort of traditional, you know, job structures and organize them. You know, I think in anything that's going to build the power of a group of workers, you know, in any sector, whatever structure it is going to help them to get a better deal. But I think long term, you know, there's really a whole set of, I think, political, you know, reforms that are necessary to truly, you know, make sure that the needs of all working people are met. And so to the health insurance question, for example, I would say, you know, we should really take health insurance out of, this is just my personal opinion, others might disagree, but, you know, we should really take health insurance out of the domain of employers, right? We need something like a universal health insurance system, so that when workers are negotiating with employers, that's not even something that needs to be on the table, because they know their needs will be met there, and they can focus on other issues like workplace safety and wages and the like. And, you know, I think that would go, you know, in the absence of that, some kind of workers cooperative for people that don't have a collectively bargained contract with health insurance could be a really good idea. But I think it would be better to press for a system of universal health insurance that would make sure that everybody's needs are met there.
John, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. And once again, happy Labor Day, everybody.
John Shelton is an associate professor at UW Green Bay, author of Teacher Strike. He joined us to talk about a new union deal Milwaukee janitors reached last week. Coming up after the news, a special edition of Food Friday for new college students and anyone who wants to cook something quick without a lot of kitchen gear. I'm Rob Barrett. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up Monday at 8 on The Morning Show, love is good. Cupcakes are also good. Why not combine the two? A Wisconsin baker shares lessons in love and deliciousness. That's Monday at 8 on The Morning Show. Now, a lot of college students are back in the dorms getting used to cafeteria food, maybe ordering the occasional takeout or putting a frozen burrito in the microwave. What do you do when the cafeteria is closed and you want a home-cooked meal? You don't have a kitchen, so you can't really cook anything, right? Well, wrong. It's so wrong that our next guest actually wrote a book on how to do it. And even if you're not in college or have kids in college, who wouldn't love quick, easy, and reasonably healthy meals without creating a big mess? That's the focus on this week's edition of Food Friday. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you were in a college dorm at some point in your life, did you have a go-to favorite thing to cook using whatever materials and tools were at hand? If you've just moved in, what's the hardest part about not having access to a kitchen? If you've ever, because of traveling or because of a tough home situation, had a situation where you had not much to work with to cook, what did you do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sarah Long is the author of College Cooking 101, Fast Food Without a Kitchen. Incidentally, she's also the Chief Financial Officer and Assistant Secretary for the West Virginia Department of Administration. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on your show.
Well, you were inspired by sending your own kid to college and trying to figure out what they could cook. Could you share some of that story?
Sure. When my daughter went away to school, I was really surprised when I got the call that she did not like the cafeteria food. Not only did she not like it, but she said there was no way she was going for breakfast because it was in the opposite direction of her classes. So to get up, she'd have to get up really early to go to the cafeteria, stand in line, and then have to walk in the opposite direction for her classes. So I knew that I was going to have to send her some recipes and help her be able to cook in her room, which was really a challenge because there's no stove and no oven in an average dorm room.
And I understand you went out to buy the book on the topic that was going to solve everything for your daughter. But there was just one problem. There was no book.
That was exactly right. I went where I always go to solve problems, which was Amazon, and could not find a book of how do you cook in a dorm room without the use of a kitchen.
What, as you started to pull together recipes, and we'll get into some specific recipes and the different tools, but what were the key things that had to be in a recipe to include it in your book here?
Well, first of all, you have to think about what does a college student have access to? What do you have access to in a dorm room? Most college students have a Keurig, so they have a hot water source. Most college students have access to a microwave and a blender. My daughter was allowed to have a toaster. So you have to think about what can I do with what I have and then frame the recipes and what you're going to cook around what you have access to.
And what I learned looking through your book is take that microwave. There's a lot more that we could do in a microwave than I thought. How versatile can we be with our little microwave?
Right. Very versatile. And I think you'd be surprised on how good some of this food is in the microwave. Eggs, for example, are wonderful in the microwave. And when you cook them in a mug, they come out in a circle, which is great for taking them on the go. Put them in an English muffin or on a bagel, and it's just the perfect shape to take with you.
Well, you just led us right into one of the recipes you've shared with us, the Western omelet in a mug. And we've got this up at WPR.org/Food Friday. Tell us about this mug-made Western omelet in our microwave.
So this is really designed for my son. He loves having eggs for breakfast and having that protein. So his favorite is a Western omelet where you put ham and green pepper, a tablespoon of each of those in a mug with an egg and some grated cheddar cheese. Put it in the microwave for 30 seconds, stir it, and then put it in the microwave for another 30 seconds, and then you have the perfect omelet to take with you on the go.
Now, a big part of cooking is cleaning up afterward, and your average dorm might not have a sink in it at all. You might be headed over to the bathroom sink, say, clean things out. Does this mug clean up pretty easy with these new eggs in it?
Yes. And I definitely recommend cooking spray, though. If you're going to cook in a mug, definitely spray that with some cooking spray so that it comes out. And, you know, interestingly enough, my son, who just went away to college, who was pretty decent in the kitchen. But, you know, these kids don't really know how to do a whole lot. And he said, how do I wash a spoon? That was his question. He's so used to putting things in the dishwasher.
Oh, okay.
So I had to walk, you know, you have to like walk them through how to do everything.
This is so your college challenge. Figure out how to take a spoon that's dirty and come up with a method to make it clean. I love it. We're talking to Sarah Long about her new book, College Cooking 101, Fast Food Without a Kitchen. Advice for cooking with the basic tools, a microwave or maybe a hot pot or you name it, toaster, oven. Is this you? Did you just drop off a kid? I just dropped off two. over the last couple of weeks for their first year. 800-642-1234. Or have you ever been in a situation where you had to make do with limited cooking resources? What worked for you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Sarah, you get a lot of mileage out of a mug in a microwave. I think there's a cake in there or two, right?
Yes. Yes, and pizza, too. Pizza in the microwave.
Yeah, this one amazed me. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because you're actually mixing the flour and baking soda and whatnot in the mug?
Yes, I'm big on trying to eat as clean as possible and not using a lot of box mixes. Mm-hmm. And so my kids want pizza. I want to try to keep, you know, put the flour in there and the baking powder, and let's try to make it taste like scratch, and it really does make it taste really, really good.
Now, are you aiming to help your kids and anybody else who reads the book just skip the meal plan on campus entirely, or is this kind of like supplementing and augmenting that you're aiming for here?
Definitely supplementing. I wouldn't recommend going cold turkey, particularly at the beginning. And I think most college students, you know, they just want to do this to supplement when they're really hungry, or maybe they're not going to have breakfast, or maybe one meal. I definitely would say keep the college cafeteria, but maybe go a little bit more bare bones than getting unlimited meals, which is always more expensive.
Now, you mentioned we've been focusing on the microwave so far. You mentioned those Keurig style things. People usually make them, make coffee in them or tea. What other things are you saying we can do to actually cook with those dudes? I don't have one. I've never used one, so I don't know.
So there's so many things you can make in a Keurig. Of course, you know, coffee and tea, you know, you buy those pods in the grocery store. But, you know, hot chocolate, your Keurig, if you don't put the pods that you purchase, you can just run water through it and it becomes a hot water source. So you can make hot chocolate, you can make sweet tea, you know, you brew tea and then add sugar or honey to it and make sweet tea, oatmeal, mashed potatoes, Jell-O. I mean, there's a ton of things you can make. Just remember that you have that as a hot water source.
It's Food Friday. We're getting advice and recipes for college students living in the dorms. Maybe they just moved in, and anyone else who has little to no access to a kitchen. Sarah Long is our guest. She's the author of College Cooking 101, Fast Food Without a Kitchen. She shared two recipes with us to post at WPR.org/Food Friday. We talked about that Western omelet in a mug coming up, the peanut butter and jelly smoothie. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions or maybe a favorite easy-to-make meal without a full kitchen of your own? If you lived in a dorm, what did you eat when you were in college? If you are in the dorms right now, maybe you just moved in or moved your kid in, what gear do you have on hand? What do you aim to cook? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Welcome back to Food Friday. We're focusing this week on cooking in dorms or any other space where you don't really have access to a full-on kitchen. Sarah Long stays with us, author of the book College Cooking 101, Fast Food Without a Kitchen. She wrote the book as a part of the solution for a problem for her own kids in college. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you've been there, limited gear and supplies to make food, how did you solve that problem? What creative cooking advice would you share? Or do you have a question for our guest, maybe for yourself in a dorm or the kid you just dropped off? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to our callers now. Mark is with us in Bloomer. Mark, hello.
Hey, I have a friend, and unfortunately he did some pretty hard time on the inside of prison. And when he got out, he had some pretty crazy and creative ideas on how they made their own meals. And, you know, I'm thinking there's some correlation and similarities when you don't have access to stuff.
Mark, do you have an example, one thing that he might have shared with you?
Oh, boy. Like, creative things with crackers and cheese in a can.
All right, Mark, thanks a lot for sharing that. Well, I don't know if college students like the jail or the prison comparison, Sarah. But, I mean, I could see your book being useful not just for college students, but for anyone who temporarily or long-term has limited availability to full-on kitchen gear.
Right. I've had people say they've used it in assisted living or if they were in a hotel room for a few days, they brought it with them. So definitely there's other uses for it.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Becky now in Iota, Minnesota. Becky, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Becky?
So when I was in college, and this was 22 years ago, Tupperware made a gadget, and it's called a sat cooker. And I lived my whole entire college career out of a sat cooker, and we cooked in the microwave. We could cook whole meals, whole dishes, a whole chicken in the microwave in this thing.
Wow. And what was the name? I didn't quite catch that, Becky.
It's called the Tupperware Stack Cooker.
Stack Cooker. Awesome. Thank you so much, Becky. Yeah. Do you have thoughts, Sarah, on that kind of accessory for the microwave cooking?
You know, I was actually, my book was actually in Food and Wine magazine online, and it was just over that, you know, that there's a lot more microwave cooking gadgets coming out right now. That's a really big thing. There's a real big resurgence of microwave cookware. So it's interesting that you bring that up.
Awesome. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Valerie now in Osseo. Valerie, hi.
Hello?
Valerie, hi, you're on the air. What did you want to tell us about?
Hi, I just wanted to mention I travel for work anywhere from 50 to 90% of the time.
Wow.
And I was looking for a way to eat a little healthier than having to rely on restaurant meals, which tend to be pretty heavy and huge portions. And so I did a little bit of research and figured out how I could cook some more balanced meals in the microwave. And so some of my kind of go-to tricks are I travel with a glass dish and some microwavable plates that I can use in the microwave, safe in the microwave, and a little bit of cling wrap. And so when I arrive at my destination, I usually just run to the grocery store. I purchase some vegetables that looks good, like asparagus or broccoli. That's really easy to steam in the microwave if you just cut it into uniform-sized pieces, put a little bit of water in the bottom of the dish, cover it with cling wrap, and then just cook it for like 30-second intervals until it just has done as you like it with a fork. And I've even, of course, there's always the go-to baked potato, which is easy to do and can be a good healthy source of carbs as long as you don't load it down with like butter and sour cream and that. And then I've even figured out how to do like lobster tails in the microwave, which is pretty easy to do, really good. Same kind of basic approach, put it in the glass dish, a little bit of water in the bottom, and just cut the shells, pull the lobster meat out and lay it on top of the shell, cover it with cling wrap, and then cook it for like in a minute intervals until the fish is no longer opaque and it's done but not overdone.
Valerie, thanks so much for sharing that. You should open a pop-up restaurant wherever you go in your work travels. Thanks for that call. But that reminds me something I didn't ask you about, Sarah. Part of your goal isn't just, you know, quick and easy cooking. It's also to have healthy alternatives instead of the microwave burrito or the fast food run.
Right. I mean, because we all want our kids to eat a little healthier than calling Instacart or DoorDash and having them bring fast food to their dorm. So yeah, that was the whole point of the book is let's try to eat a little, like just like your last caller was saying. I love that she's cooking vegetables in the microwave. I mean, that's exactly what we want our kids to do is try to eat a little more basic, a little cleaner than what you would do if you just ate out at a restaurant all the time.
Valerie, thanks so much for sharing that with us at 800-642-1234. Talking to Sarah Long on this edition of Food Friday. She's the author of College Cooking 101, Fast Food Without a Kitchen. Back to your calls now. Jan is with us in Waukesha. Jan, hi.
Hi there. I am calling because I just discovered the Fasta Pasta by Rachel Ray.
or I guess you could call it the Faster Pasta.
And that's a, was that a product brand that you can buy?
Yes, I got mine on Amazon. I just found out about it from my sister who lives in another state. It's a rectangular, microwavable, plastic but no BPH container, and it comes with directions for cooking pasta, anything from spaghetti to lasagna to fresh ravioli to frozen ravioli. You put the product in, you add as much water as it says, you cook it as long as necessary. I cooked angel hair pasta, and it took 7 minutes. And the top has a sieve on the end of it, so you just hold it and tip it, and all the water comes out. You don't need to boil a big pot of water, and you don't need to have a colander.
Wow, awesome. I love it, Sarah. I think you've got some pasta in your cookbook.
I do. Penne pasta, and you can also make mac and cheese, both of those in a mug. But I love the Rachel Ray thing that you're talking about. That sounds really cool, too.
Awesome. Thanks for the suggestion, Jan. We'll go next to Jess with us in Milwaukee. Jess, hello.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's on your menu?
Well, cooking on an iron with aluminum foil.
So like an iron, like I'd iron my clothes with, that kind of iron?
Yes, like an iron you iron your clothes with. If you put a little, fold aluminum foil, you can almost make a little pan or a dish out of it, put some butter on there so it doesn't stick. You can almost fry anything you can think of, from grilled cheese to skillet dishes and even some meat. And the good thing is, with the aluminum foil, because it cools down so easily, a lot of times you can just wrap the aluminum foil around whatever you cooked and take it with you.
Awesome. That is creative. I want to go home and try this now, Sarah. Have you gone to that extreme, cook it with the iron?
You know, I have seen that on YouTube, and that is probably a little too scary for me. I don't think I'm going to try that.
I want you just to say that I've done it. Thanks for the suggestion, Jess. Time for one more caller. Mark is with us in Madison. Mark, hi.
Hello.
Hi. What do you want to share with us, Mark?
Yeah, I was more of the MASH unit of eating back in the 70s in college. My roommates and I existed pretty much on Hamburger Helper, dry box mac and cheese with peas, and if we had any money, we'd buy a can of tuna and a pack of Smoky Links cut up in barbecue beans, canned beans. And whenever anybody went home to visit the parents, whatever we could steal from our parents was always really good.
Mark, thanks a lot for sharing those memories with us. Sarah, do you get that from your kids, a little kitchen raid when they head home?
Absolutely. Yes, all the time.
All right. In our last minute or so, Sarah, we focused a lot on the microwave. If people had to get one more piece of equipment for their dorm, what would you say is the next thing that's the most versatile for cooking?
I love a blender, and I have never heard of a dorm room that would not allow a blender. It's always allowed, and because you can make things on the go. You know, throw some almond milk in the blender with some fruit, maybe some Greek yogurt, and you have a meal. So I love a blender, too.
I love it. Sarah, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Sarah Long is the Chief Financial Officer and Assistant Secretary for the West Virginia Department of Administration. We talked with her on Food Friday, though, about her new book. It's called College Cooking 101, Fast Food Without a Kitchen. And we've got two of her easy recipes posted at WPR.org/Food Friday. We talked earlier about that Western omelet in a mug. That's a microwave recipe. She just mentioned the blender, too. And we've got a recipe you can throw in the blender, a peanut butter and jelly smoothie. It's got frozen fruit in it, but yeah, some peanut butter, I guess, for a little bit of protein in there. You can check them out. Send them on to your kids in college, if any. Let us know how they turned out over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And while you're there, you can let us know your favorite easy things, maybe a favorite dorm room memory of your own or for your kids. That's over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, we're often told to find the job we love. But what if we get there and the job doesn't love us back? We'll find out why so many jobs can leave people feeling unfulfilled and what we can do to refocus our energy on the other important things in life. We'll have a conversation about math. A mathematician tells us about why math class can be so intimidating for kids and how to solve the problem of making it more engaging and overcoming some math anxiety along the way. That plus some exercise and dinosaurs. It's all coming up Monday here on Central Time. We just got some great Food Friday advice for students going into college. I'm going to share some of that info with my two first-year college students who we dropped off over the last couple of weeks. But now I've got the opposite situation. What do we cook without kids in the house? A lot of our cooking over the last many years has involved making foods that they might actually eat. Now the sky is the limit. My first grocery store trip since they left, I skipped some parts of the store that used to be standbys, gum, pizza rolls, that kind of thing. My first shot at a no-kids food was an old standby of mine that I was reminded of by a Food Friday segment a few weeks back. I got me some canned salmon, mixed it with cream cheese and pepper. You throw that mix on some rye bread with mustard, some of my fridge pickled cucumbers, a little fresh tomato. Got yourself a real good sandwich there. Good news, it was good. Bad news, my wife thinks it's gross. She's never liked that salmon cream cheese spread. So still only making food for half the household with that one. Back to good news again. I made lots of oven-roasted eggplant and zucchini, which gets 100% support from the remaining household. Next step, breaking out the iron, cooking with it. I just want to do it to say I've done it. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.